Several European nations start their coronavirus vaccination programs amid lockdowns and concerns about the spread of a new variant of the virus. The UK's fishing industry chief criticizes the post-Brexit deal, saying that the government went back on the promise to regain full control of fishing waters. Bangladesh is reportedly set to move a second group of Muslim Rohingya refugees to a remote island despite calls against it. Here with World News, with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting with COVID vaccinations, several European countries have started vaccinating their population against COVID-19. This while a new strain is spreading across that continent and beyond. The countries using the Pfizer-BioNTech jabs for the mass vaccination include France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Slovakia, and the Czech Republic. The most vulnerable groups, like the elderly and the healthcare workers, are the first to get the shots. The new variant of the virus that emerged in the UK has pushed the EU to quickly launch the coordinated rollout of the vaccines. Coronavirus has so far killed 340,000 people and infected more than 14 million others in Europe. Canada has reported the first two cases of a new and more contagious variant of the coronavirus, which first emerged in Britain. The acting chief medical officer for Ontario says that a couple was diagnosed with the strain in Durham municipality with no known travel history or exposure to high-risk contacts. The officer says the couple has been placed in quarantine. He also called for the reinforcement of a province-wide lockdown to stem the new strain. Many countries, including Japan, China, Brazil, and several European nations, have already reported cases of the far more quickly infectious disease. They've also suspended their flights to and from the UK. Now, in the meantime, thousands of truck drivers are still stranded along the UK's border with France, thus amid concerns about the spread of a COVID variant. The trucks are parked up on a motorway leading to the English port of Dover. Thousands of them have managed to cross into France after the authorities lifted the ban. The border was closed following the discovery of a new coronavirus variant in the UK. Britain has deployed hundreds of troops to help clear the trucks. The drivers have to take a test, and only those with negative results can cross into France. The process has angered the drivers who want to go back home for the New Year holidays. The World Health Organization is warning that COVID-19 outbreak will not be the last pandemic to hit the globe, calling for efforts to make the world a safer place for everyone.
History tells us that this will not be the last pandemic, and epidemics are a fact of life. But with investments in public health, supported by an all of government, all of society, one health approach, we can ensure that our children and their children inherit a safer, more resilient, and more sustainable world.
The WHO chief underlined that COVID-19 has messed up the world, leaving behind far-reaching consequences for societies and economies. He noted that any efforts to improve human health are doomed unless they address the critical interface between human beings and animals. The WHO has taken an initiative called the One Health Approach. It aims to design and implement programs, policies, legislation, and research for several sectors to bring the countries together for better public health outcomes. Well, time now for the news review section. The Brexit trade deal that the UK agreed with the EU on Thursday has raised objections both among British lawmakers and fishermen. Senior pro-Brexit Conservative MPs expressed alarm at plans to rush the 2,000-page document through Parliament in just one day. former Brexit Secretary David Davis says that he's only ready to give his in-principle approval. Other senior MPs say that they need time to scrutinize the agreement on sovereignty terms. Meanwhile, the head of the National Federation of Fishermen's Organizations said that his industry was betrayed. He says the government went back on the promise to regain full control over fishing waters to get a wider agreement with the EU. Britain is leaving customs union with a bloc and the European single market on the 1st of January. The country begins to regain control over its fishing waters only after a five-year transition period. Time now for some insight on this. Let's first get some review of the reactions around this from Robert Enlakish, our correspondent in London. We'll then go to Keith Feldman, professor of international economics and finance with the City University of London. Robert, tell us more about the reactions. MPs are not happy about it. They say this is not enough time. A couple of thousand pages of report of the agreement, and then just one day.
Absolutely. There's been a lot of debate over what this will actually mean. And of course, many opinion pieces have been written on this. One thing that we see throughout all of the reporting on this and public opinion is that everyone seems not to be very happy with this. It has been stated many times that, of course, a deal is better than no deal. However, with this deal, we've had talk of this having a greater effect on GDP, long-term GDP of the country than even the pandemic. The economic situation, of course, is not great for many people in this country at this current time, especially due to the impacts of the global pandemic on the economy. On top of that as well, as you just mentioned in the intro there, fishermen and the fishing industry is not very happy. This is one of the key sticking points around the pro-Brexit argument. For Brexiteers, they argued that they wanted full sovereignty, and one of those rights that they felt that they wanted granted was full access to their own fishing waters, which they don't feel like they have come up with the best deal. On top of that, there's a lot of debate surrounding what this will mean for security, data sharing, and a number of different issues as well. So what we've seen in terms of from right-wing and left-wing media outlets here, and also all of the reporting and interviews that we've seen from and also on social media, is that nobody seems to be very happy with this. This is from a prime minister who essentially ran on a campaign of saying he had an oven-ready deal there, ready for people, but we've seen that that was not the case, and that the country was lied to. And of course, having this sort of leadership at this time during the pandemic, people really feel that they've been betrayed by the government.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, Professor Pilbeam, just on Thursday when we were doing this agreement live, both the EU official, von der Leyen, and also British Prime Minister, they took a sigh of relief and they say this is the deal we wanted for. They felt proud and all that. And now we have the fishing official in the UK saying that his industry has been betrayed. Let's have your comment.
Well, it will keep the Tories from a no-deal Brexit, you know, because a no-deal Brexit would be a complete disaster, and they know that. So, you know, this is better than no deal. On the other hand, the fishermen, let's be honest, it's 0.1% of the British economy. They were always going to be sold down the river, as we would say, by this government. No one's going to sacrifice some sort of deal for that. So they've got to vote, and they've got better than they had anyway. You know, it's not great for them, but it's not worse than that, so they won't be worse off. The trouble is, it says nothing about all the people that will be made worse off. The new bureaucrats I've got to pay for, 50,000 of them. All the customs declarations. We will start seeing the queues build up again. There's nothing on services. People have lost their rights to live and work abroad. So, in fact, it's not what's in the agreement, it's what's not in the agreement, all right? And what's not in the agreement is access to the single market in the way that we wanted it and we had it, you know? And we've gained nothing. I mean, we had tariff-free trade anyway, except we got tariff-free trade with loads of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. So, Professor, what are those officials who've been into these lengthy marathon talks proud of, they say? Because Mr. Johnson felt so happy and he was bragging about it, that's the deal. We'll have our own businesses. Certainly, we'll go back to businesses and industries and manufacturers and all that.
Well, we've left it to the very last minute, the deal as well, so it's created even more uncertainty. We've got virtually no time to implement it. So, and as for manufacturers, I mean, they've gained nothing, all right? And supplies from Japan will not count in the rules of origin. The British had argued for that. They've been told that they won't. So we don't know. Some goods still could still be hit by tariffs. And of course, the impact on foreign direct investment is why bother putting your factories in Britain? Might as well put them in France, put them in Belgium, put them somewhere else with easy access to the markets. All right? So the long-term consequences, nothing about the payments, the 39 billion, hardly mentioned in the press. Ridiculous. It's 39 billion being wasted.
Professor, you said it's better than a no-deal scenario. In what way is it better then?
Well, I mean, no deal would have meant us imposing tariffs on the Europeans and then imposing tariffs on us with immediate effect. And that would have been absolutely disastrous. So we're talking of a disaster rather than an absolute disaster. The bureaucracy, the paperwork, people will start complaining about it, the costs of it. The Northern Ireland border comes into effect. A border between the Great Britain, the so-called Great Britain, and part of its, UK, which is the Northern Ireland. A border. Can you believe it? There's going to be fines if you enter without a permit into Kent. £300 fine for a lorry driver because they want to keep the lorry queues down, out of the public eye, as usual. So it's a deal. It's a crappy deal, but it's not a complete disaster of no deal. That's all I can say about it.
Okay. Thank you very much for comments and contribution. We had Robert Enlikish, our correspondent, who joined us from London, also Keith Goldman, Professor of International Economics and Finance with the City University, also joining us from London. Bangladesh is planning to move more Rohingya refugees to a remote island in the Bay of Bengal, and that's despite rights groups' calls to stop relocations. Bangladeshi officials have been quoted as saying that some 1,000 refugees will be moved to Basanchar Island in the second phase of the relocation. Dhaka claims it's only moving people who are willing to move from the existing overcrowded camps, hosting more than 1 million people. The United Nations says it has not been allowed to carry out a safety assessment of the place where the refugees are being taken to. Refugees and humanitarian workers also say that some of the Rohingya have been coerced into going to that island. Rohingya Muslims were forced to take refuge in Bangladesh after a wave of torture and killings in neighboring Myanmar. They have refused to go back over fears of further violence. Now, the co-founder of Free Rohingya Coalition, Nay San Luen, says that the relocation of the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh will result in further isolation of the vulnerable minority group.
For me, if I have to say my opinion, I don't like at all because it is completely isolated, and also there is a threat by the cyclone, and also it looks like the prison. You know, you have no way to go back to the mainland, and there is no public transportation at all. And we don't know, maybe the NGO now, you know, in the beginning they are there, the hospital staff are there, doctor are there, but a few months later they can despair, they can leave from the island because this island is will be always threatened by the cyclone, and also it is very far away from the mainland. You know, nobody want to stay. And if one, the Bangladeshi foreign minister said, you know, that they will turn it to the resort or the place for the homeless people. Even the homeless people didn't interest to move there.
Resistance delegates from Syria, Palestine, and Iraq have come together in the Syrian capital to mark the first anniversary of martyrdom of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Soleimani. They praised his vital role in the fight against terrorism in the region. Our correspondent has a report from Damascus.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir ez-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal and Deir ez-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Well, like we just mentioned, the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror icon, General Soleimani, just around the corner. Our correspondent in Afghanistan has talked to a number of people there about the assassination.
The assassination of General Qasem Soleimani has not largely affected Iran's regional policies. The U.S. had thought that it could challenge Iran by assassinating the general, but it failed to do so. Likewise, the Islamic Republic has pressed ahead with its policies in the region.
General Soleimani was a key figure in combating terrorism and had a very active role in this regard. The United States assassinated him because it was aware of that fact.
1 year has passed since General Qasem Soleimani was assassinated, but his killing has failed to weaken Iran and impact its regional policies.
The U.S. killed Soleimani to deal a heavy blow to Iran, but it has failed to achieve its goal. The U.S. carries out such actions to serve its own interests, regardless of which country it is dealing with.
At least 10 climbers have died and several more gone missing in mountains north of the Iranian capital city following heavy snowfall. Rescue workers have retrieved 9 bodies from the Alborz mountain range where the hikers were caught in a blizzard and a subsequent avalanche on Friday. One more individual lost his life in a hospital. Red Crescent teams have rescued 14 people, but 7 are still unaccounted for. The search operation had to be stopped at nightfall due to bad weather conditions. It resumed at the break of the day. And that brings to the end of this broadcast.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Welcome back to Aperture. In the first part of the program, we saw how herbicides used by the Australian government decimated its employees and left children and partners critically ill. Assured by the government that it was safe, it was common for Australian workers in the 60s and 70s to use toxic herbicides without using proper protective clothing. Since then, a terrifyingly high number of these former government employees have died or become seriously ill, almost certainly as a result of their constant exposure to dioxin, a deadly chemical impurity found in herbicide 2,4,5-T. Of course, 2,4,5-T has now been banned, but stay with us as we investigate how a lack of regulation and testing of cheap imports means potentially deadly levels of the dioxin may still be present in weed control products today.
Yeah, all clear there and left me.
Yep.
Molly Dunn believes she knows more than most in Yarram about the toxic aftermath of spraying 2,4,5-T and 2,4-D. She had a stillborn baby 5 months into a pregnancy. At the time, her husband Percy Dunn was a sprayer for the Victorian Lands Department at Yarram.
They didn't actually have protective clothing back then. No clothes, no masks, no nothing much, you know.
Percy Dunn died of cancer in 1980. The 60-year-old had been ill for many years after spraying the herbicides in paddocks and along creeks to kill blackberries and ragwort weed infestations. 2 years after he died, Molly took the Victorian government to court and was awarded $17,500 in workers' compensation. But no liability was admitted. All these years later, she's still grieving his death. Percy Dunn's family is believed to be the only one in Yarram to have received government compensation.
Do you think it's wrong that families like yours only get compensation when they're prepared to go to court?
Yeah, well, that's the government, isn't it? They don't want to pay out anything unless they have to.
And there'd be surpluses in those drums too.
It's very similar to the asbestos cases that I've been involved in. The denial is put forward. The worker's got a battle to prove beyond reasonable doubt, and it's very hard to do in chemical cases.
In Yarram, many of the sprayers have died.
Very short breath, though.
Yeah, well, me too.
Tony Cassidy and Pat Reed are the lucky ones, sick but still alive.
Anyway, he's looking at you, Doc.
Righto.
I've got cancer of the bladder. In fact, I've got to go tomorrow for more exploratory surgery.
How many of your mates that you used to spray with have been sick or have died?
Oh, well, all of them are sick. Some are probably not as sick as me, but they're all sick. And I'd say probably 75% of them have died.
Any breeze, you've got it all over you.
You're wet through some bloody days.
What, just covered in stuff?
Yeah.
Sprayer Pat Reed thinks he was unwittingly dragged into a cover-up when he was told by his boss to bury about 80 of the drums on Crown land just outside of Yarram.
Tree over there, the clean one.
Oh, right, okay.
About there.
About there?
Yeah.
Pat took us to the site of where he buried them more than 30 years ago.
They put the axe through them up on the truck and threw them into the hole, and I crunched them up with a dozer and then filled it all in.
Nothing there.
We knew there was something going on, digging a hole out to put drums in, so something funny.
Out in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah.
Why do you think the Lands Department asked the men to bury the drums?
Drums there.
Because the heat was on. Get rid of them. We don't want them on the premises because people were starting to snip around and ask questions.
It should never have been used for manual spraying or aerial spraying. It was a poison that you couldn't contain.
It wasn't until the 1990s that 245T, which was thought to be more toxic than 24D, was banned by all states in Australia. This was some years after the United States took it off its market. What made 245T so toxic was the heating of the reaction mixture during manufacture, which created dangerous dioxins.
You can not ensure that dioxins are not being formed even if you employ the best production processes. I think this is one of the reasons why 245T was banned, because what you require is an additional step, which is a purification step, and that is relatively costly.
Many people don't realise is that the second chemical in Agent Orange, 24D, which was developed in the 1940s, is still widely used.
A plane dusts a field of young wheat with 24D.
24D is a cheap and effective weed killer.
The destruction of many weeds is complete.
There are more than 200 24D products registered in Australia.
It's used in many agricultural applications. It's used in pastures and cropland for broadleaf control. It's also used in areas that people probably wouldn't expect, such as turf spraying for sporting fields, for councils in their cosmetic applications, for verges and those sorts of things.
Many of the major chemical companies are represented by a peak body, CropLife Australia.
Weeds are a massive cost. If you had to manage them in other ways, we're talking, you know, just for a normal farm, thousands of work hours.
Hey there.
Hi.
So this is the sample.
Great.
It's generally assumed that there's no dangerous dioxins in 24D due to today's improved manufacturing standards. But 3 years ago, a team of Queensland scientists set out to prove there were no dioxins in pesticides and were amazed at what they discovered.
We actually didn't believe the results. We said there must have been a cross-contamination because these levels are not possible anymore today. They were, for some of the pesticides, similar to what was known from 245T, which was banned in the 80s, 90s.
Associate Professor Carolyn Gall sent her researchers back to the laboratory to repeat the tests. And when they returned positive, she expanded the study to include other pesticides, including 24D. Tests on one 24D product came back showing moderate levels of dioxins. This product was made by a Brisbane company, but it may have had its active ingredient imported. There's no way of knowing, as the regulator classifies this as commercial in confidence. Many Australian companies today import their active ingredients from countries like China and India.
What that really means is that it depends on the manufacturer, as well as the year of manufacture, as well as the batch or the country of manufacture, on how much dioxin you actually produce or have left as an impurity in the 24D formulation.
We've been told many, many times over the years that industry has cleaned up its act, that they have new processing equipment, new techniques, new technology that will eliminate dioxin from their herbicides and therefore from our environment. But I think the latest studies that are showing these contaminant levels indicate that that's not the case. The industry hasn't come clean about the nature of the contaminants of dioxin in 2,4-D, and the government really needs to take a close look at this.
Despite the low to moderate levels found in 2,4-D, its widespread use rang alarm bells.
So if you have a moderate toxicity but you use very high volumes, then the risk could be the same as having very high toxicity but very low volume of use.
2,4-D was tested, and the level of dioxins that were found were lower than elsewhere in the world. So that gave us some comfort.
That gave you some comfort?
Some comfort.
That they found moderate levels of dioxin in 2,4-D?
That it was low to moderate.
The regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, decided to see for itself if dioxins were present. It repeated the Queensland tests.
The APVMA came in and also tested for dioxins in a range of chemicals, and we worked with the health department as well in assessing the outcomes of that. And
when you tested, did you find dioxins as well?
I understand that when the testing was done, we did find some levels of dioxins, and that's when it's been referred to the health department.
Did you find it in 2,4-D?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Exposure to dioxin is consistent with this pattern of adverse health effects, and I think that there are solid scientific reasons to be concerned about dioxin exposures following 2,4-D use.
Four Corners decided to test for dioxin contamination in one of the many imported products. We purchased 2,4-D weed killer from this warehouse in Sunshine just outside of Melbourne and sent it to government laboratories for testing. The 2,4-D weed killer, Aminos 625, was imported from China by an Australian company, Senonda, based in an office in Melbourne. We purchased the 2,4-D weed killer, which is often sold direct to farmers, no questions asked. It's almost 3 weeks on, and we've just received our results from the government laboratory. Alarmingly, our sample of 2,4-D weed killer came back with dioxin levels almost seven times higher than those found by the Queensland scientists. And what's even more disturbing is we don't know how many contaminated 2,4-D products are out there in the community because authorities are not routinely testing. Four Corners gave the results to Associate Professor Carolyn Gauss to analyse.
I was actually surprised because you only analysed one formulation and actually returned such a high result. I thought it was unlikely today, but again, that is a reality check when we think back to our previous study where we actually didn't expect any contamination in the pesticides. It just demonstrates again that what we're seeing today is equally or even worse than 10 to 20 years ago, and that is of concern, of course.
Each year, more than $100 million worth of 2,4-D products are sold in Australia, and we don't know which ones contain imported ingredients.
We have seen a new scenario develop in Australia with high Australian dollar, massive production increase in places like China, and fairly free trade between the two countries, that a large amount of product is now coming in. The country of origin, as I suggested, doesn't automatically imply good or bad. What we do need to ensure is that we deal with reliable suppliers.
But it's not just about having a reliable supplier. Scientists say we should be monitoring for dioxins in all pesticides. And that's the job of the regulator.
Without monitoring each of the batches or regular monitoring, we pretty much don't have any chance to really realise what is being on the market and how much of the dioxin is being released with pesticide use.
The APVMA hasn't found any evidence of high levels of dioxin in imported chemicals.
Are you testing for it?
The APVMA doesn't do independent testing. However, it is concerns about potential quality of imported goods is often referred to us from many different sources.
But how do you know if they've got dangerous dioxins in them?
If there were high levels of dioxins, it would affect the final chemical, and we would expect to see in the public use concerns about the efficacy or the chemical itself, and we're not seeing that.
Who should test for dioxin in these imports, the companies or the regulator?
Well, I would suggest that any regulatory system should have an independent testing regime to it.
We also don't know how much 2,4-D is being sprayed around Australia.
The lack of volume data makes it really hard to make any kind of sensible risk management decisions. If you've got a chemical where there's an identified problem and you don't know how much is being used or where it's used or in what circumstances it's being used, it's very difficult to develop sensible regulatory, make sensible regulatory decisions.
I would suggest to you those who are advocating the need for it don't realise that it's actually not necessary, or in fact you're just going to bury the regulator in data and them not able to make a good decision.
Regardless of how much is sprayed, it's too much for David Brewer, an organic wine producer in South Australia's Riverland. David Brewer used to lecture in chemistry at Roseworthy Agricultural College in South Australia.
It's a foreign chemical. It's something that we would have no part of, and yet it's on our grapes. It's on our sultanas, and it can only have come from somebody else's property. It's a trespass.
Tests found that David Brewer's table grapes had very small residues of 2,4-D. But he's concerned it could have been one of the cheaper generic imported products.
What is it about these imported 2,4-D products that are so attractive?
Well, A, they're cheap. They're cheaper to start with, and B, they go further. So they're more efficient, if you like, in killing weeds.
But more effective in contaminating other properties as
well. Absolutely. Yeah, that's a real problem. Like, once it's finished at their place, it comes over here and has a go at ours.
There was a ban on spraying 2,4-D esters, the most prone to drift, at the time David Brewer's grapes were contaminated. It's almost impossible to trace the origins of vapour drift, as it can travel up to 100 kilometres.
Well, most cases of spray drift are usually because people aren't obeying what's on the label, or it could be accidental.
2,4-D drift has damaged thousands of hectares of cotton, market gardens and vineyards around the country. The South Australian market gardener, who does not want to be named for fear of losing customers, says he's constantly losing produce from drift from farms as far as 10 kilometres away.
Cos leather's growing nicely.
Bottom line is, they can't use a chemical that does damage to other people. There's no compensation for anybody that gets damaged, so it should really be eliminated.
You can see the weird growth deformations. It's got these protruding growths sticking up from the side of the tomato.
This grower says the drift is causing many deformities in his vegetables.
You've got female where they're supposed to be male, so they're mixed up with the pollen. And you also do get corn deformities where you'll get multiple cobs on a single cob.
The mysterious part of it is that 2,4-D can render significant damage to a vineyard, a cherry orchard, a tomato field, at levels that can't be measured in the air. It's that toxic to plants, particularly if the drift and exposure episode occurs when the plant is going through the fruiting stage. In other words, the plant's flowering, beginning to form fruit.
7 years ago, the Australian regulator put restrictions on when and how 2,4-D high volatile esters could be sprayed. But the complaints of drift continued. Curiously, the day Four Corners was to interview the regulator, it announced a proposed ban on high volatile esters.
We're going through a show cause process to ask industry to come back to us with why these chemicals should still be available, and from then we will make the decision about the future of the chemicals in Australia.
But some believe a ban will not go far enough, as there are other forms of 2,4-D that may drift that are still on the market. The APVMA started a review of 2,4-D in 1995 because of concerns about its potential harmful effects on humans, animals, and the environment. It's yet to finish that review.
Why do you announce that you're going to review a chemical in 1995, but you don't do anything until 2006?
As I mentioned, I can't comment on what was behind that announcement. Typically when you come to chemical review, if you're concerned about a chemical, you do announce to the public that you are looking at such a chemical.
11 years ahead of time.
That sort of time frame is perhaps unusual.
Australia's regulator must walk a fine line between arming farmers with the best tools and protecting the community from potentially dangerous chemicals. Today, there's almost 10,000 agricultural chemicals used in Australia. Some, like 2,4-D, have been around for generations.
It is not acceptable that chemicals take 10 or 15 years for review when there have been identified problems with them.
What are the risks?
Well, the risks are that unsafe chemicals are being continually put in the environment, being used in farming communities, and we are eating those in the food that we eat.
Some would say the time to take a risk with these old chemicals is over. Certainly Nigel Sinclair and his family believed this. Tragically, Nigel never got the answers he was seeking. He died shortly after our interview.
I'm sure you'll agree with me that it is an unfair equation to lose valuable human life just to get rid of weeds. And that's it for this week's program. Thank you for your time and attention. Until next week at another Aperture, it's goodbye.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to another program of For a Better Life. In this program, dear brothers and sisters, I will be talking about Islamic business ethics. It is sometimes said that business ethics is evil. How can one do business and still be an ethical person? Isn't business all about self-interest, greed, and making a lot of profits? Yes, it is true that the physical earthly dimension of a human is based on two main characteristics. Number one, greed, and number two, anger. The former attracts whatever it perceives to be beneficial, and the latter repels whatever it perceives to be harmful. But the spiritual, heavenly dimension of business ethics consists of mind and conscience. Mind and conscience, dear brothers and sisters, which have the potential of controlling the elements of greed and anger. Because it was greed and anger who took 20 to 80 million of our African brothers and put them into slavery and shipped them in those horrible means on those horrible ways, horrible behaviors that those slave masters had, shipped them to North and South of America in the great cross-Atlantic slave trade. 20 to 80 million Africans who suffered immensely, and not talking about those millions of Africans who died and perished in the Atlantic Ocean. It was greed and anger who led to colonization and colonized countries for 300 years with people, deprived those nations from their wealth. We deprived those people from their own wealth and made ourselves richer, all in the sake and name of profits. We shipped slaves in horrendous ways to the North and South of America, and we shipped potatoes and other objects like fish and food items to Europe on the way back. All of this in the name of profit. When profit is checked with greed and anger, this is what you get. This is the outcome. We colonized Vietnam. Later on, when they kicked out the French, US came in and we killed and massacred and genocide 3 million Vietnamese, all in the name of natural sources. Greed and anger, when it is unchecked, when we do not have conscience, we do not feel any conscience, then that can lead us to dangerous path which will only inflict suffering upon nations and people. And still today we see this greed, where we are using human beings as just mechanical tools, digits, a number. We're just using them as we are using robots in huge billion-dollar corporations, all in the name of profit. So when we add the adjective Islamic to business ethics, it might surprise some. But one has to realize that Islam is more than just a religion in the spiritual sense of the word. It is a way of life. It embraces, it encompasses all the dimensions of human life, and one of them is business.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
There is no difference between the sphere of worship and the sphere of business. Islamic laws govern the family life of Muslims as well as they do when it comes to social conduct. And the foundation of Islamic business ethics depends on the Quran and the Sunnah of the Prophet. This earth, dear brothers and sisters, is our abode. It is our home. This earth and its surrounding atmosphere have the resources to sustain our lives on it. But as you can see, because of greed and anger, we have demolished our atmosphere, we have demolished our ozone, we have demolished our environment, we have sound, air, plastic, vision, pollution, all of these different kinds of pollution. When it comes to sound pollution, air pollution, you have vision pollution, all of it because of greed and anger. Even look at our farms. Some farms do not believe in the free-range chicken or free-range cows or free-range sheep. They just put them in a factory and they are forced to stand day in and day out and eat genetic modified food. And the lights are modified. So they turn off the lights so they sleep earlier, and then they turn on the lights so they wake up earlier, so that they produce more and more. These are not healthy food items. We are destroying our atmosphere and our environment from all different aspects. And we have to do something about it. When you have ethics in business, dear brothers and sisters, we can develop green economy systems. We can develop a green environment. We can develop a renewable energy system. We can develop green technology, renewable energy, and so on and so forth, without demolishing, or at least having the least footprint on Earth. So we have to control greed and anger. Satan is our enemy and will try his best to misguide us. Divine guidance will come to us and we are expected to follow it. The life on this earth is for a fixed time only. We have to have death in front of us. Think about death. You should daily, as a Muslim, think about death. Not in a way that you get depression, no. You think about death and then you will rectify your actions. The hereafter is the final destination. When you have the hereafter in your mind, when you brush your teeth, when you go and play basketball or handball or football, when you go to your job, you have the hereafter in your sight, that will help you to correct your deeds, to rectify your deeds. The hereafter is the final destination. Whether the final destination will be blissful or painful depends on you, whether or not we are following the divine guidance. So in Islam, we say that the human being is Khalifatullah fil ard. The human being is the vicegerency, the steward of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on the earth. And one of the responsibilities of it is to have ethics in all the dimensions of our lives, to take care of the atmosphere, of the environment, and of the animals, plants, and minerals. Till next time, dear brothers and sisters, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you, and please join us in future programs here for a better life. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. Oh. All I need to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you mean to me.
Love is all I need. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.